Green Sense Radio is brought to you by Green Sense Farms. We're changing the world with sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
Welcome to Green Sense, a weekly look at the people, policies, and innovations that are changing our world. Here's Robert Colangelo.
We have put together a stunning show for you today. Bob Kessler, executive producer, is here to tell us more.
You know the poem, water, water everywhere, but not a drop to drink? I think I'm getting that right. Well, that could become a thing of the past. There could be a major breakthrough when it comes to desalination. Wastewater might not be wasteful. If we treated it right, it could turn green. Green, I'm talking about revenue green from wastewater.
All coming up on this edition of Green Sense. Many underdeveloped parts of the world are surrounded by water, but in order for it to be drinkable, it has to be trucked in over great distances. Desalination has not been feasible on a large scale until now, thanks to an innovative way to involve solar power. Jose Alfaros with University of Michigan School for Environment and Sustainability and has been testing this out in Mexico, and he joins us now. Welcome, Jose.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Tell us what's innovative about your new system using solar for desalination.
Well, there's a couple of things that are pretty innovative. One is the way we're writing the controls on the system so that it's a cheaper way to control what we're doing. And I should back up and tell you that what we're doing is linear Fresnel, which has not been widely used. But in many areas of the Sun Belt around the world, it's very economical. And that tied into the way we're controlling the mirrors to be able to focus them allows us to make it a lot cheaper.
Tell us what linear Fresnel is.
Well, it really is a series of flat mirrors that are parallel to each other. And these mirrors track the sun over an axis. And so they all move together in combination to reflect everything onto a receiver or reflect all of the sunlight into a receiver.
And how does that desalinize water?
Well, really what we're doing is basically boiling the water. So these mirrors focus onto a receiver. The receiver gets really hot and the salt water is being flowed through there through a heat exchanger, and the heat evaporates the water, leaving behind brine or highly concentrated salt water. And we then condense the water that's been boiled, and that is the distillate. And the brine is used to further evaporate and get salt.
Fantastic. Why has this not been tried before?
Well, actually has been tried. It has been done. What we're trying to innovate on is the areas where we're doing it and how we're trying to make it very low cost and very easy for small communities to do this as their source of drinking water.
So a major drawback for desalinization is that it's expensive and not economical for a large scale. So talk about the cost of your technology and how you've been able to get that cost down so it's affordable for smaller communities?
So in the case of the prototype communities that we've been working on, we are competing with a system that trucks water from almost 90 kilometers away. And it ends up being a cost of around $10 per cubic meter of water. And we have been able to get down to $9 or $8 per cubic meter of water. Now, this is when you compare this to the cost of, say, your tap, and here in Ann Arbor, where we live, or where I live, or even in Costa Rica, where one of the countries we're evaluating, this is very expensive, really, really expensive. But when you compare it to the system as usual, then we're taking into consideration all of those outside costs and we're able to compete.
What about quality? There's two things when it comes to water. One's volume and availability, and two is quality. Is the quality of this water better than the water that's being trucked in?
Yes, absolutely. Actually, in the case of Tastiota, Mexico, where we have been doing some work, they get water that is not potable. They can't drink it. They use it for everything else, but drinking water, they actually have to go out in their boats or on their probably 20 kilometers away and buy bottled water to drink. The water we're producing is actually drinkable, and it's distilled water. Our initial results show us that we're getting quality almost in par with bottled water that you would buy at the store.
My guest is Jose Alfaro with the University of Michigan School for Environment and Sustainability, and we're talking about the use of solar power to aid in desalinization of ocean water. Jose, you've been trying this out in Mexico in a remote area. Has this changed the life for the people in these smaller communities? And if so, how?
Well, unfortunately, we're not yet to implementation. We're still at testing and prototyping at the University of Sonora. But you can imagine the communities that we're working with. We have two communities that are target for us right now. One in Mexico, like you mentioned, one in Costa Rica. The town in Costa Rica has probably 300 inhabitants, and the only way they can get potable water is to take a boat, an outboard, kind of one of those little canoes with a boat on it, across the Gulf to get bottled water in those big 50-gallon drums. So you can imagine the change that it would be just in consumption of fuel and the economics of how you get that water to be able to get your water right there from your own land. Also, these are both fishing communities. And I didn't know this when I started doing this research, but they actually need fresh water to wash the fish when it comes in so they can preserve it and sell it better. Right now, they can't preserve it, so they have to sell it to communities right next door that actually have water, and so they end up getting a lower price than it's in the market. And this way, they can actually wash it, preserve it, do all of the value added themselves, and they would get a better price at the market. Not to mention, we're hoping that they will also start selling the salt that we would be gaining from the byproduct.
So those all go into making the value of the water much greater.
Absolutely.
What is the potential for this technology to be used in other places in the world? You know, the Middle East, Israel. I could just think of a number where water is scarce and there are long ocean areas. And if this is cost effective, it could have some widespread application.
Yeah, absolutely. And one thing that we're trying to differentiate is the scale versus replicability, right? Because the technology we're creating is modular. So we don't have to build a huge plant to be able to make a difference in a community. We can actually replicate across very many communities and be able to have an impact that way. So we're talking about areas around the equator and some areas that get high direct solar insolation. The number of communities is huge. We're talking, like you said, communities in the Middle East and Israel, but also on the coast of Africa and along the coast of Latin America and Chile, Peru, which are very dry as well.
One of the challenges with solar And one of the challenges with water is it's in demand 24 hours a day. Solar is only available when the sun shines. What happens to productivity when you don't have sun?
That's a great question. This is not like photovoltaics. We're talking about direct radiation. So when there's clouds and when it rains, we actually don't get any production. And, you know, photovoltaics go down in production, but they don't completely shut off. Of course, at night they do. But in our case, what we're trying to do is work with the communities to have a comprehensive solution for their water. And that means tying our technology with water harvesting, rainwater harvesting, and other purifying techniques so that they can have water 24/7.
What about storage and having a buffer capacity when the system's not operable?
That is a big part of what we want to do, and that's why we are working with water harvesting, because water harvesting takes very, very little energy, so we can create an inventory during the rainy season, at least in the areas where we're working. For example, Costa Rica and the area of Guanacaste where we're working, they get 1,000 millimeters a year, which is, for some areas, that's huge, right? That's a flood. But they only get it during certain months, during certain periods. So by building inventory and building a buffer, then we can easily manage the 24/7 supply. In other areas, we would have to do more pumping and gravity-fed buffer systems to be able to have 24/7.
Sometimes when we solve one problem, we create another. If desalinization happens on a wide scale, what kind of impact is it going to have on the ocean water and the environment?
That's a huge issue for us. We really are systems thinkers. My track that I teach at the University of Michigan is sustainable systems. So we don't want to just dump this water back in the ocean, and that's why we're creating, eliminating the salt. So there's two main environmental impacts we need to think about when we're doing desalination. The first one is high concentration of salt, and the second one is a high temperature in the water. When you dump high temperature water, it affects the ecosystem that you're dumping it in, and also the salinity will affect it. So in our case, what we're doing is we're capturing that water. It's not going back to the ocean. We're completely evaporating it to recover the salts that are in the ocean, and actually making that an advantage for us by selling the salt that we get as part of the business plan.
Dr. Alfaro, when do you see this going into application?
Oh, I wish I could say it's going to go early in the year 2019. Right now, in the summer of 2018, we're finishing our prototype and getting all the testing. I hope that if we get some good funding, we would be able to have a functioning unit by the middle of this year, 2019.
Well, thank you for joining us on GreenSense, and we wish you the best of success with your project.
Well, thanks a lot. It was a pleasure talking to you.
That's Dr. Jose Alfaro with the University of Michigan School for Environment and Sustainability. This is Robert Colangelo, and you're listening to GreenSense. Subscribe to our podcast at greensensefarms.com.
This is Bob Kessler, executive producer of GreenSense Radio. Every week, we cover environmental issues and meet passionate people and sustainable innovators. You might have noticed we do it with very few commercials. Our advertisers, they're just part of what supports GreenSense. We need the help of our listeners, also passionate people who care about the planet and know the value of independent media, which matters now more than ever. We've just launched our fundraising drive so you can help us continue to bring you informative and inspiring shows. Your contributions will cover our small production staff, which seeks out and schedules interviews, edits them, and puts together GreenSense every week. Plus, there's the cost of online hosting and studio equipment. So when you visit greensensefarms.com, click on Radio Show to make a contribution via Podbean. It takes just a few minutes, and as we often say on the program, individual actions multiplied by millions can yield big results. So if you're inspired by our positive and informative shows, we're asking you to help keep GreenSense going. Visit greensensefarms.com and click Radio Show to contribute to our fundraising drive via Podbean. On behalf of all of us at GreenSense Radio, thank you. GreenSense Radio is brought to you by GreenSense Farms. We're changing the world with our sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live, so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
One man's trash is another man's cash. Dr. Kelvin Okamoto heads up Gen 3 Bio, and he joins us now on GreenSense to talk about their new technology that transforms algae from wastewater into revenue. Kelvin, welcome to GreenSense.
Thank you for having me.
Well, there are 16,000 wastewater treatment plants in the U.S. Explain how your process works, where you start with wastewater, and then what happens.
Okay, municipal wastewater is we consider to be clean when it's discharged into whatever rivers or lakes or whatever. However, there's a lot of nutrients in that water typically. And what algae can be done is algae can be used to actually reduce or eliminate the nutrients that are in that discharged wastewater. And the reason why you want to do that is that that reduces the nutrients that are available to actually creating hazardous algae blooms or dead zones in open waters. So this is a way to keep our waters clean by not putting as much nutrients into the water from what we discharge. Algae is used by various companies that have algae growth technologies for municipal wastewater treatment facilities. Unfortunately, at this time, most of that algae, if it is generated, is actually landfilled. Gen 3 biotechnology allows us to take that algae and convert it into specialty products using a proprietary enzyme blend technology. And therefore generate revenue from the specialty products.
Where does the algae come from? And how, in the process, where do you come across algae? Do you add it? Or do you find it in the wastewater stream?
Actually, the wastewater stream is put through a contained algae growth system that actually contains the algae. The algae is actually, these processes are actually run by other companies that have been doing this for 10 to 15 years. And Gen 3 Bio then takes the output of those companies, the algae that they grow, and brings that in internally. So at this time, Gen 3 Bio does not grow algae. We just process the algae itself.
And how do you make money from processing the algae?
We make money because what we do is when we use our technology, we get out the fats and the sugars and the proteins, and we then convert them into specialty chemicals through fermentation or other means, and then we sell those chemicals. We get money from that, and we then return a percentage of the net revenue back to the wastewater treatment facilities.
So do the companies who own the algae pay you a tipping fee to take away their impacted algae?
Not at this time. That is not what we are going after. And we also do not charge them for taking away since we will be making money on the chemicals we generate from the algae.
But don't they? How do they discharge and dispose of their algae currently?
A lot of it is landfilled. And yes, that is a cost to them, but we were helping them avoid that cost.
That's very nice of you. It sounds like there's a potential revenue stream there.
Yes, there is a potential revenue stream there. At this point in time, that right now algae is often sold at anywhere from 2 to 5 to 10 cents a pound. So it's not a large amount of money that we would especially pay for that. So to avoid those kinds of worrying about those kinds of accounting, we work on it on the other side.
put this in context and give us some perspective. What volumes of algae are produced on a weekly basis from the wastewater treatment plants?
While I go to annual basis, if you don't mind.
Sure.
One of the facilities that we've been working with is a 4 million gallon per day wastewater treatment facility, which is a pretty small facility. As an example, within Indiana, Carmel is 12 million gallons per day. So 4 million gallon per day facility is actually not that large. From that, on an annual basis, you generate about 2 to 2.5 million pounds of algae for that year, and can generate, with our process, somewhere in the region of $2 to $2.5 million of revenue per year. If you count the costs and everything else, they'll get some amount, you know, get $500,000 back to the wastewater, $250,000 back to the wastewater treatment facility.
So, Kelvin, those sounds like pretty big volumes. So what kind of a truck are you sending to the wastewater treatment plant on a regular basis to pick that up?
And very good question. And actually, to avoid that, what we do is we build our facilities right at the wastewater treatment facility so that we are not shipping water around and not having to dry the algae and then rehydrate it off-site. So we actually concentrate algae to a 5% loading in water and then process that. Once we then process
that's
that.
That's excellent. So you're really sustainable.
Yes. Yes.
I'm talking with Dr. Kelvin Okamoto of Gen 3 Bio, who has developed a process for making algae from wastewater. We hear about toxic blue-green algae. Is this the algae in wastewater that you're dealing with, or is it a different type of algae?
It is a different type of algae. Some of the toxic blue-green algae is of the same family that may be grown in these controlled algae processes, but they are grown in such a way that they do not convert to the toxic algae stage.
And what kind of specialty chemicals come out of the process on your end?
The sugars we can ferment to, and the one we're pushing right now is succinic acid. Succinic acid is a foundational specialty chemical that can generate a lot of other specialty chemicals. The market for succinic acid itself is anywhere from $4 to $8 billion per year. And from its other chemicals, you can generate up to $16 to $20 billion worth a year. The other thing with succinic acid, its biggest use is actually for polymers that are water, soil, and compostable. Water and soil biodegradable and compostable. The lipids can be converted to biodiesel. The proteins you can hydrolyze to amino acids and various other chemicals.
All these specialty chemicals are currently manufactured using other processes. What's special about yours, and why does it have less of an environmental impact and produce, you know, hopefully a better profit?
From an environmental standpoint, we can say that our chemicals are coming out from a recycled carbon process, which means that the carbon that would have been put into the atmosphere or into the water and then released to the atmosphere is going back into something that we can sell and reuse. And in terms of cost, because we are getting the algae for free or nearly low cost, and our process is moderately inexpensive, we can hopefully generate the special succinic acid and other chemicals at a lower cost than the present processes can.
Wastewater and geology have been around for a long time. Why did it take so long for someone to discover this true potential here?
Very good question. I don't know, honestly. I haven't been in the wastewater industry long enough for me to understand the full history of the technology.
In closing, I just want to give a shout out to Dan Dawes at the Purdue Foundry. He's a good friend of mine. He introduced me to you. And the foundry is the incubator at Purdue, and they're cranking out, you know, hundreds of startup ventures. So they've done a great job. Is there anything you want to say about Purdue and the foundry and your involvement with them?
Yes. And I have to thank Dan Dawes and the Purdue Foundry and actually the Purdue Research Foundation for helping Gen 3 Bio really start to get to be where we are and allow us to get to what we believe will be a growth platform going forward. We moved over from Ohio, and since in the last 2 years, we've really seen a lot of help with the pitch and our technology. And we owe a lot to the Purdue Research Foundation and so on. The other part is that I do need to state that GentryBio did win the Accelerator Challenge at the end of 2017. And with the monies that were invested in GentryBio, we have been able to complete our first mobile pilot plant.
Kelvin, thank you very much for joining us on GreenSense. And we are very proud to see you taking your idea into reality and wish you the best of luck.
Thank you very much.
That's Dr. Kelvin Okamoto of Gen 3 Bio explaining how they're transforming wastewater and algae into revenue. I'm Robert Colangelo, and this is GreenSense. Subscribe to our podcast at greensensefarms.com. We hope you enjoyed this edition of GreenSense. Visit greensensefarms.com to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, and you can check out the list of radio stations that air our show. All you have to do is stay fresh, keep innovating, because when you're green, you grow.
GreenSense Radio is brought to you by GreenSense Farms. We're changing the world with sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live, so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
GreenSense is recorded in the Duneland ecosystem on the eastern shores of Lake Michigan. The program is copyright GreenSense Farms, all rights reserved.